Welcome, and thank you for your interest in Chagall. My name is Masha Chanova. I'm a lecturer here at the Museum of Modern Art. And I will be talking today about Chagall's nomadic modernism. As an epigraph to the talk, here's a quote from Chagall himself. "There was Japanese, Egyptian, Persian, Greek art. Only from the Renaissance on has national art been on the wane. The boundaries have dissolved. Artists arrive, individuals, citizens of some country, born somewhere. And one must have a good registration, or even a passport expert from the Jewish section, in order to be able to firmly establish the nationality of all the artists." And I'm showing you photographs of Chagall at different stages in his early artistic career. On the left is Chagall in St. Petersburg. He is born, as you may know, in a small town in the Pale Settlement, in the town of Vitebsk. And at age, he's born in 1887. And at age 20, in 1907, he comes to St. Petersburg to study. This was not exactly a typical move a Jewish born man or woman could do, but he nevertheless comes and manages to obtain a permit. Jews were not authorized to live in big cities in Tsarist Russia. So Chagall either does or does not manage to obtain a permit to stay in St. Petersburg. It's a bit of an ambiguous story. And then he stays and studies there for 3 years, 1907 to 1910. And here he is in 1910 on the left. In 1910, he's able to go to Paris and spends 4 years in Paris studying the most radical and the most advanced art on a private fellowship. And then in 1914, he comes back to Russia. He's actually forced to return by the onset of the war. And so the second photograph here in the middle is Chagall in Vitebsk, back in his native town of Vitebsk, where he's now, after the revolution, the commissar of the arts, basically the main arts administrator. And he can find, and I will tell you about this in a little while in greater detail. And on the right is Chagall in Moscow in 1920. He leaves Vitebsk at the end of 19, and in 1920 he makes probably one of his most famous artworks that I will show you at the end of the talk today, his so-called aesthetic manifesto, or the aesthetic manifesto of his early career. And we will devote some time to that. These are the famous murals for the state Jewish theater. And this is just a kaleidoscope of images to give you a range of visual material, and just to see how, you know, to give you an idea of what Chagall's early art looks like. I'm sure you know it, but also I chose the images that have all these flying figures flying over, and this is called Over Vitebsk. This is flying over the village, again, I'm referring to Vitebsk. This is just called Traveler Onward. And so here's a traveler again, and here is a flying carriage. Chagall's art has been difficult to categorize. Over the course of his artistic career, he has been associated with various artistic movements: Orphism, Cubism, Suprematism, Surrealism, only to escape any one definition. His early style, before he definitively moved to Europe in 1923, is generally considered more radical. Yet even for this period, many left-leaning art historians have trouble coming to terms with the artist's formal experimentation that is somehow always coupled with traditional interests. The most common categories into which Chagall's art has been inscribed by art historians, namely definitions and expressions of national identities, Jewish, Russian, and French, undoubtedly point to the gist of Chagall's artistic project. Yet they also circumscribe it in their own way, by creating that very aura of nationalism that the artist persistently resisted. In this talk, I want to focus on that aspect of Chagall's art that makes it appealing to a radically minded modernist who regards any nationalistic aspirations with suspicion, who is comfortable with uprooted identities and unresolved stylistic contradictions. In what follows, I will try to demonstrate that at the core of Chagall's artistic project lies a kind of nomadism and scale of thinking that is inalienable from the most radical artistic projects of the early 20th century, such as that of Marcel Duchamp, who diagnosed himself famously with the spirit of expatriation and cultivated a nomadic identity both in his life and in his art. In his insightful recent work on Marcel Duchamp, the art historian T.J. Dimas defined the state of exile as, and I quote, a tension between forced displacement and an unhinging of the subject from legal and national borders, the latter resulting in possibilities of artistic and subjective freedom, end of quote. So thus, far from suggesting any direct parallel between Chagall's and Duchamp's project, I merely want to look at Chagall's art from this angle of nomadism. I will show you, or try to show you, that this angle allows us to discover and appreciate a radicality in his artistic project that is often overlooked. And we will start by looking at this probably best known, or one of the best known works by Chagall in MoMA's collection. And I will, throughout this talk, I will focus on works in MoMA's collection that you can. This one actually is now back on view on the fifth floor. Some of the other works are on and off, so you can come back and, you know, one day you will definitely see them. And if you really, really want to see them, you can always request to see them in storage. So this is Eye in the Village, made in 1911. And it's probably one of the best integrated works into the international canon of modernism. And on the one hand, it's easy to see and to feel at home with it as a work of international modernism, right? Because you have these bright colors, of the early 20th century, the bright red and the green and the blue, pioneered by the fauve painters, the wild beasts, in 1905. And of course, Chagall is familiar with this. You also have the circles inspired by someone like Robert Delaunay, an artist working in Paris and a close friend of Chagall at the time as well. Yet, what are we to make of the subject matter of this work? Why, who is this figure, the eye of the artist, looking into the eyes of a cow? And there's actually a physical line that connects them, two lines. You can better see this in when you look at the work in person on the fifth floor. So what are we to make of the subject matter? And we know that at this moment, Chagall is one of the thousands of foreigners coming to Paris, well, thousands, hundreds for sure, numerous artists who came to Paris at the time to soak up its atmosphere of experimentation. And here's Chagall trying to define his own identity. And what I would claim is that this work, as many of the works from this early period, show Chagall's place at the intersection of several places that he comes from and that where he is situated. One of them, of course, is his firsthand knowledge of Jewish traditions in Vitebsk, and both religious and secular traditions. At the same time, he has embraced the emerging Russian avant-garde in St. Petersburg, and he continues to stay in touch with it at this moment. And then at the third direction would be his fascination with French modernism, of course. And he shows himself here, Chagall shows himself as a high school student with his cap on the right. Oops, I think the battery's dying on this thing. I hear this. Okay, with a high school hat, and that's why we know. And then he shows himself back in his childhood times, and yet he has a cross, a Christian cross around his neck. Here. Which is quite unusual. There are also Christian, there's a Christian church in behind him. Vitebsk, of course, combined a Jewish population and a Russian population. And then on his finger, at the same time, you have a Star of David. So, you know, it's this, even he even represents himself as a kind of cross, as a kind of mixture of different cultures and religious traditions. And then the subject matter, in the subject matter, the village, or in the title, the village refers to this Russian word mir, or world, or universe, or in Yiddish, in fact, it refers to the same thing. It refers to the Christian peasant as the symbol of this idealized, harmonious relationship to the land. And so you have Chagall showing himself an I and the village in that kind of nostalgic nostalgia for the, we could say, the economic backwardness of the shtetl, while he himself is in Paris. So, it's an image about fantasizing an identity out of place and time, we could say, or in relation to a specific place and time. And of course, just to show you that Chagall's, this work is so well known, among other things, because Alfred Barr popularizes Chagall from very early on, from 1930 on. Alfred Barr, of course, the first director and chief curator at MoMA. And as if MoMA's institutional weight was not enough, Chagall also gives this watercolor on the right to Hilary Bey, who later then makes it part of the Guggenheim's collection. It's a slightly later watercolor, but it is based on the same motif. So two major museums in New York own this work. Not surprisingly, then, they're so well known visually to us. And here are two other works from the same period. On the left, Self-Portrait with Seven Fingers, and on the right, Paris Through the Window. So here is the young artist trying to forge his identity, and he is looking, as you can see here, at once as a Janus face, this double-faced figure. He's looking east and west at the same time. He is here also with his easel, showing the Eiffel Tower outside of the window, and at the same time he's conjuring up in his mind his beloved Vitebsk. Here is the kind of cloud coming out of his mind, right? And then you have him painting a work that is also a direct homage to Russia. It's called To Russia, Donkeys and Others. And here, donkeys is actually, yes, a reference to the animal, but it's never so simple with Chagall. It's also a reference to the young avant-garde artist in Russia who had just organized an exhibition called Donkey's Tail. They had attached, the symbol was typical of the avant-garde, of an avant-garde gesture, was to attach a brush to donkey's tail and then let the donkey walk outside and make the painting. And so this was the, you know, the double gesture. So here's Chagall pointing to, referring, kind of situating himself in relation to, yes, French modernity, yes, the most radical painting in Paris, including Delaunay's Bright Colors or Cubist fragmentation or fractioning of space, and then modernity itself. And yet he also conjures up the goats and cows of his native town and shows himself with these multiple identities. So what does it mean to say that, let's stay here for now. So what does it mean to say that Chagall's modernism was nomadic? And I would like to propose three kinds of nomadism in relation to Chagall. And here's the first kind that I've already outlined, is this geographic nomadism. Somebody who is displaced, uprooted, who is moving from one place to another. Okay, there's nothing, you would say, you would be right to say there's nothing unique in that way about Chagall. Many artists in the 20th century, and non-artists as well, have to move because of the wars, they immigrate. There are all kinds of reasons people are moving, but not everyone makes it into so central to their artistic identity and to the such a central subject matter in the artwork itself. So for Chagall, this kind of physical displacement and the lack of fixed identity is a very rich source of exploration. And then the second kind of nomadism that I would propose is the religious nomadism. And I already tried to show you that Chagall is at the conflation of Jewish background, also coming from a generation of the youngest Jews who, yes, they grew up in the traditions, but they really also give them up very easily by moving to towns, by embracing the Russian culture around them. And actually, Chagall studies with someone named Leon Bakst in St. Petersburg, who is a convert from Judaism to Christianity and a very mystical, symbolist painter, which was not uncommon at the time. So Chagall deals with that kind of crisis of identity on that level too, And here is an image, another work at MoMA's collection called The Calvary. And first originally known when it was, it's 1912, made in 1912, and then it was first exhibited in Berlin in 1913 under the title Dedicated to Christ. So if we look at it quickly, here's a crucifixion with two figures standing underneath, and then another strange figure with a ladder coming up, and a man in a boat in a river coming up behind. So, okay, it's a figure of a crucifixion. What is so unusual? And why would Chagall, even as a young man, undertake such a subject matter? If we look a little bit closer, we begin to get more and more puzzled, because we can see the figure of Christ is clearly not a figure of Christ. It's a figure of a child. And here's a sketch that also is at the museum's collection. You can see a little bit clearer that this figure is a very kind of grotesque, distorted figure. And here he's actually wearing a Jewish shawl here. This figure was extremely enigmatic. When Alfred Barr acquired this work, as when he acquired most of Chagall's works in 1949, in between 1941 and 49, Chagall was in New York as a refugee from Europe during the war. And Barr had helped him, actually, to get here. And he had organized a major retrospective of Chagall in 1949. And this is when he acquired most of the major canvases that MoMA owns. And right after that, Chagall being conveniently in the neighborhood, Barr sent him questionnaires asking very detailed questions, as Barr would, about the subject matter and what the artist intended. And so Chagall luckily gave very detailed descriptions of what it meant, this figure, what he meant by this figure, and why this was painted like this. And so this painting actually was little known. It had not been exhibited between 1913 and 33. It was owned by someone privately who did not want to exhibit it. And so it didn't make a scandal, but it was quite controversial, and art historians were trying to figure it out. And the replies that Chagall gave did not help to resolve anything, in fact, because what Chagall said, and if you look at these figures here, you can see a little bit better. The man is wearing a uniform, almost, and the woman is dressed like a Jewish woman. They definitely are not traditional figures surrounding the cross. Chagall said, well, yes, they are my parents, in fact. And yes, my father was this double the size of my mother. And he also replied in a kind of Chagallian way, typical, he is my father and anybody's father. This figure here with a ladder is a figure of Judas wearing a Jewish tallis, a prayer shawl. And when asked why he gave Judas a letter, Chagall said, well, I wanted to bring him down to a more human scale. How it brings him down to a human scale, and what does it mean for Judas to have a letter going up like this, is kind of an interesting question in itself. There is also, Chagall never really said it directly, but there are a lot of suggestions to think that the Christ child is, in fact, Chagall himself. Or it's not even Christ child, but the figure on the cross would be very likely to be Chagall, especially given that his parents are underneath, and given that Chagall had written poems where he identifies with Christ. And it was generally a typical kind of longing to have in the early 20th century symbolist environment in Russia and outside too. Blaise Cendrars, who was a close friend of Chagall in Paris, a poet, had identified Chagall with Christ in his poetry. Chagall himself had written poetry as a young man, thinking, oh, I'm suffering and all of this. And so, okay, there's a biographical basis, but at the same time, what does it mean, if you think about it, to completely desacralize, or at least deeply undermine, conventions of Christian and Jewish iconography? Because in as much as it could offend a good Christian's feelings to see the scene like this, it could also offend the Jews to have Judas represented like this. There are all these very, very provocative connotations in this work that really I hope, show you how complex Chagall's relation to religion was. And this kind of fluidity that he has with the religion, the religious subject matter, perhaps could be what allowed him later, when he's a famous, very famous figure in the 60s and receiving commissions around the world for buildings of all kinds of denominations, for a Catholic cathedral in Meretz, for the United Nations building, for synagogues in Israel. For he would move very freely between these different spaces, and there was something about his project, his artistic project, that allowed him to be flexible and at the same time satisfy those who commissioned the works. So there is this religious nomadism, or I would define it as such. And then there is, of course, the third kind, and I would spend a bit more time on this, more time on this kind of nomadism, and that's, of course, stylistic, where Chagall would kind of pay tribute to various artists, and he would, yes, borrow certain aspects of their styles, but he never associated with any specific movement. And whenever he would be forcefully associated, he would always refute it in one way or another. And here is Birthday, this work also at MoMA, that I put next to two works by Matisse. I hope this is self-explanatory enough. This is a kind of, I think it comes closest. It's a painting by Chagall that comes closest to Matisse's sensibility for the decorative surface, for the ornamentation, for this saturated bright colors that are then all these surfaces put next to each other, and I hope you can see the echoes in his works. But then, of course, the major figure for Chagall, as for anyone in Paris in 1910, would be Picasso in Cubism. And I'm showing you a drawing that Chagall made on the left that became known as Thinking About Picasso. But what the Russian text here says is really ambiguous. It's a deliberate pun. It could mean, I have had enough of Chagall, Picasso is thinking, or it could mean Chagall has had enough of Picasso. You know, so they basically, you know, it's this kind of love-hate relationship that they're noticing each other, or so Chagall thinks. But it's Chagall's trying to come to terms with Picasso's looming large in Paris. And of course, you, I hope, have noticed already, and you will notice more, that Chagall borrows and uses a lot this kind of geometric fragmentation or geometric analysis of space in the background. But then here you can see this is a kind of game on what Picasso is doing. But here Chagall includes a figure, a fantastic, phantasmagoric figure in his own style, and then there is a house, a tilted house. So it's a combination of representation in the more conventional way and cubist idiom. Here is a more direct homage to cubism in a work that Chagall calls Cubist Landscape here on the left. And you can see this is a very good mastery of what cubists Braque and Picasso are doing in the 19-teens. And I'm just showing you a Picasso for the fun of it, because here's one work. It's actually also on the fifth floor right now, that where Picasso is using Russian letters. It's very rare, but just as a kind of dialogue. And also visually, to show you, you know, when cubism becomes about putting a representation together from fragments, Chagall is doing just that. But then what does he do in addition? He shows lurking behind the art academy that he himself founds in Vitebsk in 1918. He, after the revolution, Chagall, as I already mentioned, becomes an important art administrator, the head of the arts in his town of Vitebsk. And he founds an academy, and he opens an art museum, and he does all these things to compensate for what he himself was lacking when he was a young man. And all these things are possible now after the revolution in 1917. And he invites all the most radical and advanced artists, including Malevich and Lissitzky and Pugny and others. And they, in fact, become his real rivals. And the real danger for Chagall or for his career comes not from Picasso, but from Malevich. Because famously, as you may know, Malevich one day, and Malevich is an abstract artist by then, who had invented suprematism, right? And he has a lot of students, he's extremely charismatic. And one day when Chagall is gone by his administrative business, trying to raise funds and make sure everything is running, he comes back and all of the students are converted to suprematism. So, and to abstract art. So Chagall has no more place. It's not so quite so simplistic, the story. But the kind of offense that he took with Malevich stayed with him for the rest of his life. And here I'm just showing you that there was a reason for them to be rivals, and that is that they share something fundamental about their understanding of painting. And here is Malevich's early work from 1913 called Cow and Violin. Of course, cow, how appropriate, in relation to Chagall, right? And then cow is placed next to the violin in order to create this kind of unexpected juxtaposition that then breaks the conventional meaning, or breaks our expectations about a conventional meaning. If we can see a perfectly representational cow next to a perfectly representational violin, then we see them one on top of the other, and what does that mean exactly? When Malevich exhibited these works, he called them allogical paintings, paintings refusing logic, and he even put a subtitle in the exhibition space saying, the content of the works is unknown to the author. So, you know, here is an avant-garde provocation. And Chagall, after 1914, between 1914 and 22, is very much part of that context of the Russian avant-garde. And he's in a dialogue with it, an active dialogue at that. So, in the middle, you would be surprised, is a work by Chagall. I'm saying you would be surprised because it's probably as abstract as it ever gets with Chagall. And I'm putting it next to a classic collage by Picasso and a classic abstract painting by Malevich. And I hope you can see visually that Chagall is paying an homage here to both, or referencing both, liberally as he would. And yet, there is something in this work that is neither in Picasso nor in Malevich. And here is a direct reference to his, again, his Jewish background. This triangular shape would be echoing that of a Jewish tombstone in a Jewish cemetery. And what it says here is, in Yiddish, is tzedek, meaning justice. There's some kind of narrative behind. What are we to make of this? Are the viewers supposed to read the narrative? Are we now to say, okay, Chagall's art is about the narrative and the literary story? He always insisted, no, it's not. He always said, actually, in relation to Cubism, there's something interesting. Chagall said, when he spelled out what he perceived as the main difference, he said, for the cubists, a painting was a surface covered with forms in a certain order. For me, a painting is a surface covered with representations of things, in which logic and illustration have no importance. So, you know, if we are to follow his word, to trust his words, then we shouldn't follow the logic yet. Of course, art historians love to decode things and get the meanings pinned down. And of course, this has been read in relation to a major event in Chagall's life, which is the exhibition of his panels for the Jewish theater, which I'm going to show you in a minute. So if, you know, we have situated Chagall in relation to French modernism, we have situated it a little bit in relation to the Russian avant-garde. And what remains to be done is to see how he relates to what is really a very important trend going on at the time, and that is the formulation or search for a modern Jewish visual style. Because when Chagall is in Paris, there are a number of artists coming from Eastern Europe or from Russia, or from Western Europe as well, trying to formulate what is going to be the modern Jewish art. There was no such thing at the time. And Chagall, famously typical also of Chagall's kind of irony, he said, well, I let them talk and I just did my painting. But of course, he is relating to his Jewish identity in a certain way. And most famously, it has become expressed in these murals. I'm sorry, the reproductions would never do them justice, because they're large panels. I will show you a bigger one in a minute. But you can actually see these panels live right now at the Jewish Museum. There's an exhibition called Marc Chagall and the Artists of the Russian Jewish Theater that is still on through March 22nd. And these works are on view there. They belong to the Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow, but they were brought for this show. So you can still go and see them. And they're fantastic. And there are so many details, and you can come up close. So this is the space of the original Jewish theater for which Chagall made these panels. This here is the introduction. And actually, in the exhibition at the Jewish Museum, they're installed exactly the way Chagall painted them. They imitated this room, so they're installed exactly in this way. And we will only focus on two of the, what I think are most interesting panels for our purposes today. This is called Introduction to the Jewish Theater, and it's here. This would be the entrance. The stage would be there. And so there are windows, and between the windows you would have these four panels for the four arts, and here behind would be Love on the Stage, this work. So if you look at the Introduction to the Jewish Theater, you can see, I hope immediately, that the relation to the French modernism with its kind of fragmented space and the bright colors. You can also see even, you know, these circles that were there from Delaunay's inspiration on. But you can also see that it's very, very representational, and it actually has quite a bit of detail in it. And there is a lot of biographical, there's a biographical level to this, and there are a lot of bio details. For example, the green cow, which I forgot to mention to you at the beginning, but think back to the eye in the village and the cow. The cow, on the one hand, is a symbol of this peasant universe, right, of course, and the idyllic world of the countryside, but it's also an alter ego for Chagall. And he had famously said, I often said that I'm not an artist, but some kind of a cow. What's the difference, after all? And he said, and this is, I'm just quoting Chagall, what's the difference? I often thought of placing a green cow on my calling card. Mm-hmm. So, you know, his interest in the grotesque has, and his interest in the kind of absurdity of things, making things look uprooted and absurd, is very much present in the symbol. And here is the green cow coming in on the left. And here you have the so-called administrative side of the painting, or of the story. It's a literal introduction to the Jewish theater. Here is the artistic director of the Jewish theater, Abram Ephras, carrying Chagall and offering him to the director of the theater, Granovsky. And here's one of the actors watching. Oops. So this is the kind of administrative side on the left. In the middle, you have the musicians, the klezmers, the famous wedding entertaining musicians. And then you have these clown-like, circus-like figures together with another cow. And then here you have a figure urinating. Could be quite shocking, but it's also very telling of how Chagall is destabilizing all of the high and the low and the authority of a space such as an interior of a theater would be. There's something Bruegel-like, I think, in this figure, right, who is holding the violin in a way that is impossible to play, and he's completely blind. You can see, and his head is turned in this very grotesque way. And here is Chagall with his wife and his daughter, so also lurking from behind one of the planes. So you have this kind of complex narrative with a lot of illustration, right, and a lot of story. And there is also a lot, there are a lot of Yiddish references and puns and cultural references of all sorts. But the work's meaning is not reduced to that alone. And one important aspect of this in relation to his kind of Jewish identity would be his coming from a Hasidic background. And the Hasidic worldview emphasizes very much this joy of life and the singing and the dancing and the merriment and the enjoyment, which is considered, rather than intellectualism, this kind of emotional joy is considered the rightful living or the expression of the truth. So this would be Chagall's background. And then you would have these clowns, Batken, or in Yiddish, the wedding jesters, who are entertaining the audience, but always always reminding the audience at the same time of the futility of the whole enterprise. So there is this kind of tragicomic side of things, and there is this circus-like, carnivalesque-like atmosphere in Chagall's paintings overall, and it's really crystallized here. And if you look at one of the clowns, he's wearing all of the religious insignia, the most serious, solemn stuff, and he's upside down, and there is a description in Yiddish says, "I am having fun," or "I frolic," you know, and he's upside down right next to the cow that is upside down. So here's, you know, one of the clues to Chagall's kind of nonchalance or apparent irreverence of all authorities. And here is an image that is also very much uprooting all the seriousness. Chagall was a perfect figure in a way for the emerging. It was the first time that Jews were recognized as a nationality in Russia after 1917. It's the first time that they are able to express their culture in their language, because it's the first time it's recognized as an official language. And that's a big deal. And there is a time, there are a couple of decades after the revolution, actually less than that one decade, we can say, when the Bolsheviks are extremely tolerant of this kind of expression of national minority. And Chagall was a perfect figure for the modern theater, because he was precisely conflating these cultural identities that I'm describing, because he was an international modernist who had been to Paris, because he grew up in a shtetl, so he knew that life, and because he had embraced Russian culture too, because this theater was popular among Russians as it was popular among the Jews at the time. And this second panel from the interior, I hope you can see quickly how much it relates, how much more it relates to this kind of high modernism as we think of it, this kind of pure pure white with very little reference to the world. It's almost geometric. You see the entire background is very geometric, but you can still see the representation of a figure, a couple dancing. Very subtle, but it's there, unmistakably, right? Chagall would never give up representational images. And also you have allegory and metaphor all the time. So you have these figures in the pit, these musicians in the pit below, who are contrasted with this, the dematerializing couple. Just show you details of this. Typically, Chagall strongly resisted, again, limiting these murals to Jewish audiences. He wanted to get a permission to have them exhibited, to have other works exhibited along with these and show them to international audiences, or at least to the Russians. And he said, when he wrote to the management of the theater, he said, "I love the Jews a lot. There is enough proof of that. But I like the Russians as well, and some other nationalities. And I'm used to painting serious things for many nationalities." Just to be clear one more time, I'm making this argument today kind of in the context of very multiple interpretations that exist of Chagall that just reduce him to either one or the other. He's a Jewish artist who is painting for the Jews or expressing their identity. He's a Russian avant-garde artist, or is he a French modern artist? Or, you know, there's this existing literature that puts him in one place or another. So I'm trying to make it messy deliberately, and to show you, okay, there's all of this in his work. And there is one final association that Chagall had, a more forced one at that, and this is with the surrealists, of course. And nowhere else more than in the West, and especially at MoMA, has Chagall been shown as a precursor to surrealist art. Alfred Barr himself had shown him in his work, in his show, in his exhibition from 1936 called Fantastic Art, Dada and Surrealism. And Chagall was there, his works were there, as one of the precursors of Surrealism. When Chagall moves to Paris in 1924, André Breton notices him right away. He knew of his work before, but in 1924, when Chagall had his first solo exhibition after his years away in Russia, Max Ernst, Éluard, and Gala come to Chagall and offer him to be part of the Surrealist movement. And he says, no thanks. And when Breton still wrote about him a lot and throughout the years, as did Alfred Barr later, in numerous MoMA's catalogs, they wrote about him as a surrealist avant la lettre, if you want, someone who is a surrealist without even knowing it. And here are two works that I'm showing you from 27 here on the left, and 33 on the right, that I hope you can see are this kind of homage to surrealism, or a very deliberate affiliation with surrealism, with this kind of sexual abandon of the woman being carried away by a donkey in a dreamlike space, or this mindscape peppered with the familiar symbols now, the Eiffel Tower or some chicken, and here again the cow, like in the Eye in the Village. But it's an homage to the surrealist. Yet Chagall always said, no, he's not just doing this. And when what Breton really liked about him was what he, and I'm quoting Breton here, with him alone, metaphor made its triumphant return into modern painting. The reawakening of the poetry of representation, avoiding factual illustration on the one hand and non-figurative abstractions on the other. So finally, someone comes along who likes the fact that Chagall is neither abstract nor representational. And Breton makes a lot out of this. And yet Chagall answered to this, refusing any association with surrealists and explaining that contrary to being a precursor to automatic drawing, the famous style of the surrealist, Chagall said, and I quote, "I always seek very consciously to construct a world where a tree can be quite different, where everything and anything is possible, and where there is no longer any reason to be at all surprised, or rather not to be surprised by all that one discovers there." So he says he's doing it very consciously, and that he's consciously constructing a world where anything is possible. It's not exactly the same as the surrealist. He's not interested in the dream world in the same way. So again, he tries to disassociate. And Chagall's self-conscious nomadism, as I attempted to describe it, coupled with his insistence on representational art that continues to provoke art historians, afforded him just this very freedom to make anything and everything possible. Chagall always insisted that his work should not be reduced to specifics of religion, stylistic affinities, or geographical location. Much of the strength of his art, I would argue, lies precisely in its refusal to fit into any single category, geographic, teleological, or stylistic. Neither abstract nor directly representational, Chagall's art has a composite nature that expands the possibilities of pictorial language. What Chagall is interested in is the space that opens up between the categories, where new freedoms appear and everything and anything is possible. Thus, Chagall can state even further, and I quote, "My art has never been an art of mere self-expression, nor an art that relies on literary content. On the contrary, it has always been something essentially constructed, in fact, a world of forms." And that is, without a doubt, a very modernist definition of one's artistic project. Thank you very much. We have a few minutes for questions, if you have any. Yes?
This is a detailed question on Calvary. There was Judas with the ladder, his parents, the baby. What about the man in the boat? Did he ever say?
When Alfred Barr asked him about it, he replied that it was to introduce calmness in contrast to the drama that goes on, and that the river was the river of his youth, of his native town. Then you have there's one very famous interpreter of Chagall, Benjamin Harshaf, who has deciphered every single Yiddish connotation in the paintings, and he's really very, very knowledgeable. And he's done very detailed research too, and he argues that there is a poem by a Russian symbolist poet, Alexander Blok, who was a very important inspiration for Chagall, and that the poem, and in one of Harshaf's books, you can find the entire thing translated, the entire poem, and it's a description of crucifixion in an image that very much resembles Chagall. Whether this is true or not, but it's an interpretation, and that Bloch is inspired also to think of himself on the cross, and this boatsman coming, and the river flowing, and Judas being there, and all these things. So that's a detailed answer. Yes.
Me?
Yes.
Wasn't this the point in time of the revolution, which was anti-religion?
Yes, absolutely.
There was a fervent attitude against religion.
Yes.
So what is he saying? Is he saying that he's for it, and whether it's Christianity or Judaism or whatever,
Oh, you mean when he works after 1917?
Yes. But isn't he fomenting them?
Well, in the panels for the Jewish theater, he does refer to traditions of Judaism, but more as secular traditions and general wisdom, I would say, than directly. Yes, you have a figure who is wearing the religious insignia. This would not be a problem so much in 1920, this figure here on the left, right? This would not be so much of a problem. There was tolerance. He's not expressing, if he's expressing the worldview of Hasidism, it doesn't mean that it's a religious propaganda. You know, on that level, it would be fine. He's a modern artist, and he is making fun of this stuff, too. Does that answer anything? Thank you. One second. Uh-huh.
What, the religious community, how was he received because he made images? In the religious Jewish community, you cannot draw an image.
Oh, yes, and this is a larger... The question was, how would he be perceived by the Jewish religious community, given that you're not allowed to make images at all? And this is going back to... Sorry? Images in the Jewish tradition. This is going back to the whole big question of the quest for a modern Jewish art, and Chagall is by no means alone in that. There is Elizitsky, for example, very famously at the time, working in the 19-teens, trying to find the roots of representation in Jewish art. And they do find illustrations in the synagogues and representational imagery that they then use as the basis for being able to represent. They're not religious themselves, right? So there's something about modern secularism that comes about with the generation of Chagall, and he's part of that. So in that sense, the commune would not treat him very harshly, just as that generation, the entire generation, would. Generally about Chagall's relation to the religion, I could say that he's interested in the Bible throughout his life, and he tries to often find the common roots of Christianity and Judaism in the Old Testament and the New Testament. That's that I know. Uh-huh.
The beginning slides. Show Chagall with everyone flying in space. Mm-hmm. Could you explain a little bit what you mean about this flight in space that it does? Or it's a one way of looking at it, maybe it's not that exactly. Why is everyone flying?
Well, right. There is not a single answer to this, and I hope that the entire talk was kind of related to... I was trying to illustrate where I was coming for the entire talk. Because you have a, I can go back to this. You have a Jew flying, you have Chagall and his fiancée flying, you have a very modern secular traveler here, kind of making a big leap through cosmos, you could say. And then here you have a carriage, which could have its own religious connotations. So there are all these different meanings behind this, and there are all these different dimensions of meaning behind this. You know, there could be several answers. But there is generally this sense of freedom and the sense of you have representational imagery that is not abiding by the laws of gravity or of representational content of the world as we live it. Okay, so we are out of time. I don't want to hold you. Thank you. And I will be here if you have more questions.